Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to A Time for Justice. A Time for Justice is a show on the Elevated Places Network, and we welcome you tonight to our show. Today is October the 26th, 2021, and I am your host, Sister Pamela Muhammad. I'm an attorney, and I am once again welcoming you to A Time for Justice. This is a show that discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion with legal minds. We discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing, we want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not the actions that we see. So our guest tonight will not make those excuses for racist conduct often seen, which are really just distractions from the truth, which is the path to justice and equal protection. And that's the path that we want to be on, the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. As I said tonight, our show, I'm so excited about this show tonight because we're going to talk about two subjects. We're going to talk about law, and we're also going to talk about politics. And we're going to combine those under the topic of seeking freedom, justice, and equality in law and politics. And we have two very, very dynamic and just very intelligent, two leaders in the community, very knowledgeable brothers that are joining us tonight. And so we are so pleased to have them. We are so humble. Let me go ahead and open up their mics so we can talk about the topic, seeking freedom, justice, and equality in law and politics. So the first brother, I'm going to open up his mic. He's a brother who we've oftentimes visits with us. He's such a gracious, he's an attorney. Gracious brother, Athiel Muhammad. Brother Athiel Muhammad is a graduate of Texas Southern Law School here in Houston, Texas. He's born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. He attended Lincoln University, where he has a Bachelor of Arts degree in political science. And actually, from the District of Columbia, University of the District of Columbia, he has he entered a graduate program with a discipline in urban policy. So this is going to be very fitting for tonight. Brother Theo is licensed in the state of Texas, the federal courts. Some of the types of cases he's dealt with: death penalty cases, police misconduct, civil rights violations, discrimination. And Brother Athiel says that he is a devoted member of the Nation of Islam, studying under the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, as now taught by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And he is a prominent staff member of the Nation of Islam's Office of the General Council. And he goes on to say in his curriculum vitae, he loves, and I can just attest to this, Brother Athiel has a great love and devotion to the practice of law, and he credits that love to the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and also the Honorable Craig A. Washington, who is a person who was actually in the legislation, congressman, and also an attorney. So he says none of those successes, you know, that he has now or in the future would be possible without his faith and belief in Allah, to whom all praises are forever due. And I want to, with that, open up Brother Athiel's mic and greet you, Brother Athiel. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Pamela, and to the listeners. And I thank you so very much for that gracious introduction. We're always honored to, you know, hear that at least somebody thinks that we do a pretty okay job, and hopefully we won't disappoint this evening with a few points that we may have to make.
Yes, sir. All praises are due to Allah. And I want to say again how humble and thankful I am to that you would come to the show with us. And really, it's, you know, it's the belief, it's the love, it's the effort, the dedication, along with the excellence in the practice that, you know, just so impresses me. And I think it's so important that the listeners know. So we're going to make sure that you give them a way to contact you at the end, Brother Athiel, because, like I say, you're a very great lawyer, and I thank you. And also tonight, we are blessed beyond measure to have a first-time guest, and this brother is an excellent scholar. He's a historian. He's a community organizer. He is just a wealth of information, and actually he puts action to it. So I'm just so thankful. The brother that I'm going to introduce, his name is Brother Kareem Anur Muhammad. And Brother Kareem is born and reared in the Midwest. Brother Kareem, he talks about how he's always been captivated about world history, with a particular interest in the study and contributions of Black history. He says a little joke at, you know, but I'm sure it's true. He said at the tender young age of 16, when he found out that Cleopatra was not Elizabeth Taylor, he found himself on a journey searching to find the hidden pieces of Black history that intrigued him. So Brother Kareem, he began his journey at a college called Forest Park State College, that's in St. Louis, Missouri, and he obtained a degree in mortuary science and African American studies. He continued on with his education in African American history, achieving a dual degree in liberal arts and psychology at the University of Arkansas in Little Rock. And actually, he says he, after being awarded this opportunity or an opportunity to study abroad for at the University of St. Louis in Senegal, West Africa, he says he returned with a broader understanding of the contributions of Black people worldwide. Now, Brother Kareem left the Midwest and came on down to the South, where working to help with those who have been displaced by Hurricane Katrina. I think he said he was working for a FEMA as a disaster coordinator. He met his wife in the Mississippi Delta. Now, isn't that a blessing? And so Brother Kareem, I think he's in the Mississippi Delta now, where he is a freelance writer, a journalist for the Jackson Advocate newspaper. He has his own podcast called Juneteenth 101, a radio show, Know the Truth Power Hour Academy, that centers around the history of Blacks in Mississippi. So he's definitely going to share some of that with us. Brother Kareem is a community-based organizer, trainer, and he established the local organizing committee of I believe it is the local organizing commission of Mississippi, and works to do so much more in Mississippi. He works with underserved communities. One such community he mentions is Mound Bayou, Mississippi, which is an area. It's like a Black Wall Street type where it once thrived with pride and prosperity, but now he's saying that this is an area that really, you know, needs attention. It needs help because of institutional racism. So Brother Kareem, he's over 25 years of in-depth research in African-American studies, and that's what he brings to us along with the 10 years of groundwork in the Mississippi Delta and so much more. So I wanted to just go ahead and open up Brother Kareem's mic because he talks about unity. And as we talk about politics tonight, we want to talk about unity as well. So let me go ahead and open up this great brother's mic and welcome him to our show. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Hotep, free the land, power to the people. Thank you,
yes,
my sister. Well, thank you for the opportunity to having me on the show. And I'm just, as Brother Theo said, hoping that it's something that we'll be able to say today that will move us forward into what we need to be doing. Praise be to Allah.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, thank you so much. I'm so honored and privileged to have you on the show as well. You know, just coming together with the believers to have these conversations and to, you know, grant any kind of benefit of our knowledge and experience and then generate conversation from the listening audience. This is what we're doing, and I'm so thankful. So let's start off. We want to start off by talking about the title. The title is Seeking Freedom, Justice, and Equality in Law and Politics. And, you know, Brother Kareem, you had done a town hall meeting back on October the 16th, 2021, and, you know, for the anniversary of the Million Man March. And one of the things you brought up as a source of information was the national agenda. And so I wanted to start off, you know, kind of focusing on the national agenda. And for those of you all who don't know, the national agenda is a public and policy issues program, plan of action that was put out by the nation as well as some other organizations, the National African Leadership Summit at the Million Man March, and this was back in 1996. And so as a result of the call of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan for the Million Man March in October of 2000, this was a draft agenda that came out. You know, people kept meeting, kept kind of making this happen, and this was a product. So it's a wonderful, wonderful book, and I encourage us all to have it. Because when we talk about, you know, the minister starts off by talking about why should there be a national agenda. And he starts off by talking about the lobbyists and how corporate, America is really controlled by corporate America and lobbyists. This is pretty much one of the topics. But I'm going to go on to the part where we talk about freedom, justice, and equality, because he says specifically, each life is born into this universe with the responsibility and natural duty to do something for itself. Otherwise, it cannot justify its existence. All living creatures must do for self, and it is this aspect of natural law that the poorer class of American people, particularly blacks, must accept their natural responsibility to get up, unite, and pool their resources and do everything that they can to develop themselves, create institutions that serve their needs, and make government responsible to create the atmosphere that will allow all of the citizenry to enjoy the principles of freedom, justice, and equality. Now, these principles are the essential principles of life. The denial of any one of these is the denial of life itself. If the founding fathers saw life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness are inalienable rights of every citizen, then we must maximize our ability to give life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to ourselves, and not just sit down and wait benevolent government to do these things for us. For the government is no longer now the true servant of the masses of the people. So I kind of wanted to really, you know, start there, because we're talking about this subject of freedom, justice, and equality, and a party. And Brother Athiel, I'm going to start with you, because law is used. We go into these courts every day to actually pursue justice. And as the minister said here, sometimes that the denial of justice, of any of the principles of freedom, is a denial of life itself. So can we start looking at where we are today, you know, in America with some of, you know, the climate that we're seeing? There's some real impingements on the freedoms, freedom of Bill of Rights, you know, freedom of speech. There's this case that came out of the Supreme Court the other day that really seems to be pushing back police brutality, making them accountable for police misconduct and police brutality. Have you gotten a chance to kind of look at that case, and would you like to give the audience any comments about these types of decisions?
Sure. Well, you know, when we're dealing, the Supreme Court is always dealing with this issue when it comes to, you know, police brutality, misconduct, whatever the situation is, and, you know, qualified immunity. And the thought has always been and continues to be that, you know, making it real, real simple for our listeners, that you darn near have the, you know, that it is such a high standard to overcome when you're dealing with somebody who, you know, a person who is a victim of police, you know, brutality, prison, you know, brutality in the prison, you know, that you have this qualified immunity argument that whatever it is that they did, that, you know, that they, you know, that it was not known, if you will, you know, the conduct that they did, they had to have known that it was, you know, against the law, against the Constitution, you know. And, you know, you can read the Constitution and say, well, you know, that that's pretty straightforward. But as we know, you know, that Sister Pamela, just having a, you know, Constitution is something that I have several of them here, you know, at home. And, you know, you put them in your back pocket. It's that small a document. But as we know, there have been volumes and volumes of volumes of cases that interpret that. And so the thought has always been qualified immunity, and what is the thing that the officers supposedly have to know, or what rights that they are supposedly violating, you know. And because they're tightening the screws, you know, of this qualified immunity argument, even to the point of you can have situations where you have something on the police brutality issue caught on videotape. And more often than not, you can still, they can still make the argument and get away with it and have a case dismissed, or a portion of the case dismissed, by just arguing qualified immunity, in the sense that they, you know, the protection that they have. And it, you know, kind of, you wonder, you say, well, darn, you know, you're looking at all of the stuff here. If something is already, you know, captured on video, and yet a case is dismissed, you know, right. Or a portion of the case is dismissed based on qualified immunity. And because we don't know what that is, even lawyers, you know, who know what that is, you know, the frustration level is still there. And so you can imagine then what the frustration level would be for those who are not lawyers and don't know what that means, or the legal machinations that, you know, were used to get a ruling in favor of qualified immunity. And, of course, you know, you have potential anarchy going on. And then you always have this rioting in the streets, or protesting in the streets, no justice, no peace. Well, the thing is, the system is already built in that, boy, if you don't, I mean, heck, if you have something that's captured on video, you may not win. So, but how many of these police brutality, and especially in the prisons where there are no video cameras and stuff, you can just imagine. In fact, as you mentioned, I was actually at one of the prison facilities this past Thursday, and a meeting with the young man, and he was telling me about the abhorrent treatment that he has been receiving at the Ferguson unit in Midway, Texas. And you know, he was telling me that he, along with other prisoners, have not even gotten a mattress to sleep on. They're sleeping on these, if you will. Now, in bringing a lawsuit against them, you know, even at the TDC, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice officials, they are cloaked in the armor of qualified immunity. So short of, and we know we don't have any video cameras there, short of there being some kind of, you know, whistleblower, if you will, or prison official, a security guard, prison guard actually coming forth and saying, no, we did this. The difficulty of overcoming the qualified immunity defense is darn near impossible. And with the United States Supreme Court continuing to tighten the screws on that, it is making it more and more difficult each day for a person to overcome, for a victim to overcome the defense of qualified immunity.
Yeah. And you know what, Brother Thiel and Brother Muhammad, Brother Kareem, I want to bring you into this conversation because I know you're a history person. So this sounds like parchment a bit. It sounds like parchment. And I think the latest couple years ago, there were a lot of things going on in the prison in Jackson. And you, if you could speak on that, because, again, we're seeing that the government is not responsible to create an atmosphere that is allowing the citizenry to enjoy the principles of freedom and justice and equality. And this is something we're seeing in the national agenda that we want. And, you know, so what Brother Thiel is saying is that the government is being more shielded from misconduct. There's no due process. And so we got these excessive force, but nobody is being held responsible, and people are being denied their right to jury trials. So, Brother Kareem, did you want to add something to Attorney Muhammad's point on that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, sister. Thank you, brother, for breaking that down like that. But, again, when we talk about freedom, justice, and equality, we have to identify why the messenger said we wanted full freedom, justice, and equality. And so, therefore, it's a difference when what we're looking at. We're looking at a system that was not made to give to us freedom, justice, and equality. As the brother was saying about the different cases of unjust death that went on in this country, we have cases after cases of proving to this system of actual wrongdoing, and we still don't get no justice. So we're dealing with a system that is geared toward not giving us no justice. I think that the first point that I would like to address is when we're talking about court systems or we're looking at a federal system, then we're looking at a state system. Those are two different types of systems. And the state system is a system that when you see Colorado or you see California, they don't really concern themselves with what the Supreme Court make a decision on one way or the other. It depends on what the decision is. But for the most part, each of those states are countries themselves. They got their own Supreme Courts. They got their own president, which is the governor. And so they govern their own selves. And so they determine who is in the prison system. They control the prison system. United States federal courts do not control Mississippi's prison system.
Yeah.
Mississippi.
Yeah. And you know what? And that's a good point, Brother Kareem. I want to kind of move on with the law and also talk about what you do as a community organizer as well. I guess, you know, because I put the two categories, like pursuing freedom, justice, and equality in the courts, and I have the pursuit of the freedom, justice, and equality you know, in the political realm. So, you know, it's, I hear the politics, I hear the court, and the thing about us as black lawyers, of course, we are fighting to get the best results in this particular paradigm. So it's a really great point you're making, because it's kind of like how in Texas, the governor of Texas has said, this is what I want to do in this state, because you've got the sovereignty of these states. You know, that's a really good point. The states do somewhat govern, but I think also you're going to get some influence by what the Supreme Court does, because then the states kind of know how far they can go. You know, if there's no checks and balances, then there's no checks and balances. It's a free-for-all. And so this is why we're talking about freedom, justice, and equality, and we're going to talk about it from the political realm as well. But I kind of wanted him to give some updates on what was going on in the courts. And I wanted to move on, if I could, because I want to get to you. I didn't know if you had some history that you wanted to share in terms of some of those types of injustices in the park. I know the Parchman Prison, which was the most notorious, you know, it's got some real history. But, okay, if I could, I just want to move real quick to the whole thing about the Bill of Rights, you know, and I know, you know, we're lawyers, so people tend, and it's good, I think it's great conversation, because we go into these courts every day, and all we have is, you know, faith in Allah, some knowledge of the statutes, and, you know, and a desire to give excellence. So that's the paradigm that we live in. And so I wanted to ask you as well, Brother Athiel. Now, I know that we talked about the impact of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in a case called Cooper versus Pat. And that had something to do with the expansion, because sometimes the law does, you know, give some redress. And so in this case, it was a case with one of our brothers in prison who was able to get his freedom of religion rights, because at one point, coming out of slavery, you weren't getting any recognition of prisoners having any type of rights. They were as if they had no rights, as if they were animals. And I know today we talk about how the 13th Amendment is stripped from people, but when we're talking about you don't have the right of speech, you don't have the right of religion, you don't have the right to read newspapers, we want to give credit where credit is due to say that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad certainly made that impact. What do you think, Attorney? You have any input that
Yes, ma'am. And what has happened is, you know, as we know, and as our listeners, you know, need to know, you know, the 13th Amendment, you know, states, you know, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Okay. What has happened was, and we know there is no absolute, you know, constitutional protections that people have. Let's debunk that right away. We don't have an absolute right to, the Bill of Rights. You know, there are, you know, laws and rules that would state that if somebody's having their, you know, First Amendment rights or Bill of Rights or rights guaranteed supposedly by the Bill of Rights, you know, that we know that if a law is impinging upon those things, that the law, the government looks at and the Supreme Court has looked at what we call strict scrutiny. In other words, you have to have one heck of a basis to, you know, overcome, you know, that for that law to be overturned for that law to be considered constitutional. Now, that being said, though, with respect to the Pate matter, Cooper versus Pate, was that, as I'm understanding, that was one of the first cases,
right,
that began to decide prisoners have rights. Now, may not be absolute rights, but before the decision of Cooper v. Pate, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think prisoners had any rights. And so this matter dealt with brother being able to, you know, have, you know, religious, you know, I guess at the time was Muhammad speaks, I believe. It may have been, you know, the point of contention. But from that, you know, there has been then a plethora of protections that have now been, you know, given to prisoners. And
right.
as the minister, you know, said, you know, in one several lectures, of course, but one lecture I remember, unfortunately not the date, but give the credit where the credit is due. You know, if it was not for the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and our brothers and sisters who were in certain circumstances and had the knowledge and had the persistence and persevered, then some of these laws or some of these protections may not even have been changed. You know, and I know this is a little bit off topic, but I have to mention this, you know, with Muhammad Ali, you know, and
right.
as a result of his steadfastness, now that was able to, and you correct me if I'm wrong, listeners and also Sister Pamela and those others, that before Muhammad Ali challenged the draft, I believe the draft was, it was mandatory, I believe it was. I'm too young. I wasn't drafted, of course, but I believe now I think as a result, now the draft had been made voluntary. But the bottom line is now that, again, giving the credit where the credit is due, the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad has been able to give us that sort of, again, impetus and courage, if you will, to fight, you know, for the freedom, justice, and equality. And, of course, now we know that so many people are, you know, for better and for a good thing, you know, protected under, you know, no matter how you want to slice it, we are all following and falling under the protections of the blanket that the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan have provided.
That's right. Okay, Brother Kareem, and you know, Brother Thiel, I totally agree with you. The teachings, the impact of the teachings is causing a mighty change. And now, Brother Kareem, we're coming your way because we are living in a time where, as Brother Thiel was saying, these rights are being even more impinged upon. You know, that I think, Brother Kareem, you talk about wanting an end to police brutality in you all's programmatic thrust. You talk about wanting reparation and restoration and equal justice. These are the demands, and it comes from the back page of the Final Call where we want full and complete freedom. And so I believe, as you're saying, now we're starting to look at the politics and forming political agendas and political parties. And so let's look at politics. The definition of politics is a set of activities that are associated with making decisions in groups or other forms of power, relationships between individuals, such as distribution of resources and status. So at its basic level, politics is about making decisions, group making decisions, you know, couples, churches, organization, your neighborhood, you know, all the way up until we look at this legislation. But we know that without the economic base sometimes, because Brother Kareem, you were absolutely right, sometimes these judges are influenced oftentimes by economics. You know, they are. I mean, in state levels too, you know. So we now are coming to where I think your area of expertise is about political models where parties can promote agendas, and let's look at concepts such as separation and interest groups. And so I wanted to open up, you know, this part of the topic because, again, I wanted to mix law and politics. And so, I just have both of you all. I'm so excited. So can you talk to us about, you know, some of the evolution of political activity that you've seen from slavery until, you know,
absolutely,
from after slavery. Yes, sir. Okay.
Thank you very much. First of all, I just wanted to definitely go back to what the brother said about of the prison system and no rights in there. But white folks have always had some rights in the prison. If they didn't have no other rights but the right not to be chained next to a black man or a black woman. So there's always
right.
been some rights. It depends on, again, when we come from a political perspective, it depends on what type of power you have and who's exercising that power for you. When we talk about political, I know there's two concepts I'd like to put down first, and that there is two types of concept of life that we see, we are viewing as a social and a political perspective. A social perspective is one that, for the most part, most of us have it. We see that the police out there beating this man up, and most of us on the corners, you see that with us. We out there, we see him beating him up, and you hear us on the corner talking about, oh, man, that's wrong. Oh, man, you shouldn't do that. And that's a social perspective. But there's another perspective, and it's called a political perspective. And see, that's the part that they don't want us to have. A political perspective, a perspective where you know what you're looking at, you know why it's being done, and you also have a perspective of how to resolve it. That's what we want to really deal with today. Our people have always had that political perspective, but the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches that we, as black people, wake up and go to bed with justice. And so we've always had that principle of freedom, justice, and equality, and we also have always fought for that right to exercise that. The only way that we didn't is that they suppressed us. And so, but even though in doing slavery, we still, and you would find us exercising some form of a political perspective. There's two types of political perspectives on that level. The brother that bought his freedom, and he's over there negotiating his contract up north. That's a political perspective, or that's a political action. Or the one, a slave down in the south, and he's resisting against what his slave or captive has done. That's a political position. And so we've always been exercising our political perspective. Only thing it is with slavery is the sense that as a so-called slave, we didn't have the right that if someone did something to our civil rights or ourselves, we didn't have a right to address, to have no redress behind it. And that is where when we came into the Civil War and other things came in, that is where we took advantage of that aspect, because we seen that as a way for us to be able to exercise our political right and have some force behind it. When the Union began to fight against the Confederate Army, black people pick up arms. They didn't pick up arms because they liked white folks. They had a political agenda that they picked up them arms with, and that was to gain their freedom. And so we've always have been dealing with a political perspective. And what okay. you'll find as you go in, yeah. you're going into Reconstruction, and we going into the Reconstruction yeah. period, you'll find that a lot of our people that was doing before slavery ended in the 1850s and 1840s, those are the Oliver Cromwell and the David Walkers and the Paul Cuffrey and others that had redresses and talked about equality, that by the time the Civil War came into play and after the Civil War, you seen those individuals begin to exercise those types of political information that they had on the larger scale. And so they
yes,
tell
sir.
Us during Reconstruction, a lot of our black politicians was illiterate. A lot of our black
right.
politicians couldn't read. But yet we were some of the most educated, the most skillful orators, the most skillful organizers that they had during this period of time. And so
okay. Now, let me ask you this, Brother Kareem, if I can interject.
talk to us and inform us that there are, were during Reconstruction, black politicians, because I know, again, you're a historian. And ultimately where we're trying to go, as we see our Bill of Rights, we see our rights being further and further impinged upon, we're looking for places and ideas on how we can come together and do politics amongst ourselves. And so I think these are some models of what you're talking about during the period of Reconstruction. So tell us about that. Where were these systems organized? Were they just in the street? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, thank you, sister. Well, for the most part, during the time of 64, 65, 66, and 67, 1864, this is right before Progressive Reconstruction came about, which was 67, 68. Black people were still, they were trying to get the hell away from white America. That was their system.
Okay.
Because the union had did this, so there was a lot of organizations, and you would find those in areas where you find a lot of cluster of black people at, East Virginia, East Texas, where you had large amount of blacks in a cluster at South Carolina, North Carolina, Mississippi. You found a lot of those individuals that they was organizing, Oliver Cromwell, Henry Holland Garnett, Henry McNeil Turner, all of these individuals. Henry Adams was organizing 67, 68, 1870, 1875. But by 1870, when the Reconstruction period came about, our people went to sleep. They stopped agitating at the beginning, and this is what happened to us, and that was because white America sold us a bag of goods. They gave us a black congressman. They gave us a black senator, Blast Bruce, and Horace Revel. And when that came about and black folks started getting the opportunity to sit in Congress and sit in the Senate, then black people began to give their allegiance to the Republican Party. And at this time, it was about the party. Whatever party you was with, you were loyal to that party. And so because of the Republican Party, which was the party of Lincoln, the party had a so-called free black folks, they came into the Republican Party. And in doing that, they stopped agitating for doing something for themselves, and they started working on trying to rebuild this system. And so in that, you'll find from 67 to 77, about 10 years, 10 to 12 years, you'll find in areas like Mississippi. You'll find in areas like Virginia. You'll find in areas like Carolina, where you begin to see black folks begin to build schools. They begin to change laws, dealing with poll taxing, dealing with changing laws, dealing with whooping poll, dealing with changing laws, dealing with opening up schools where men can now have contracts and not have to be sued or be shot. So these were some of the advancements that you found us when we began to organize on a larger scale. These are black men that had came out of the Civil War, but these are black men that were at. When you find us in these areas, you tend to find us, we was in clusters. It would be Brother Thaddeus and his wife, and maybe he had two sons, and he had a brother that had a wife. And his wife's sister might have had a husband. So they all come together. And maybe
and
they
family.
Yes, as a family. And they were at this
family.
Time, they were tenant farmers, and so they would come together. And remember, some of them were just coming out the Union, out of the Army, so they had a little money. And depends on the circumstances that they were dealing with, the planter might sell them a little piece of land. And so they were able to achieve from that. And they began to grow from that, even during this time. So for 12 years, from 65 since 1877, black folks began to advance in areas of education, in areas of building community, and you start seeing clusters of community being built. Nicodemus in Kansas, black people wanted to get away and started going into areas because during this time, the government began to talk about these land grants. And so black people wanted a part of that. And so they started going up to Oklahoma and to Kansas where the land grants was being said that it was plentiful at. And they started building, but also here in Mississippi and also in Carolinas, they start building land in the Texas, East Texas. They start building land and start building foundations, and they start negotiating with different type of political agendas at the time, which was Republican Party, which was the Greenback,
right,
which was the Populist Party. And so they utilized that, and they advanced until 1877 with what they call the Redemption Period. But white folks just got tired, and they start coming back on armed struggle and taking all of this back. So that's the beginning of our organizing.
Yes, sir. Because like you say, I think we've got this thing about organizing to negotiate with the whites, the bigger government. But then you had this other part where politics talks about building your own communities, making your own communities safe and place. Decent places to live and actually being effective to render services, as the minister said in the agenda. You want to create institutions that serve your needs. You want to do everything you can to develop yourself. And so this is, I think, what we see. And so, Brother Theo, I'm going to bring you in the conversation because I want Brother Kareem to tell us about small town politics, especially he's in a city that has a large amount of black population, somewhere around 78%, and black governments can be a model when you have black neighbors working together in common interests, and potentially can you see full and complete freedom, get closer to that in the smaller town environments, and we know that you can because the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan has talked about it. One of my favorite lectures is the Detroit 2019 lecture by the minister. It's entitled Blacks and Reparation, I believe, and it's out of NCOBRA. I just urge everybody to go and listen to that lecture because he talks about this full and complete freedom that we're going to have to find by getting out of this white man's reality, which, like Brother Theo started the show telling us, is that that's one where qualified immunity protects them from wrongdoing. And, you know, sometimes that, you know, we're just marking time. So, as I said, I want to talk about small town governments and is that a model? Can you tell us some of the good things about working in with, you know, political agendas in small towns? And Brother Theo, I just kind of I threw it out there. I wanted you to tell us how courts in big cities really do maybe differ from some of the operations you see in small town courts. Can you see some of the benefits of us operating in small town courts based on some of your experiences?
Between the two.
Yes, sir.
Interesting you say that because I was just down in probably the smallest town I'd ever been to in Texas, Anahuac, Texas, is going, if anybody's familiar, you know, with, you know, I guess what, South Texas, Anahuac is going, let's say, from Houston toward Louisiana, New Orleans.
Okay.
And the county that I was in, you know, in Anahuac is Chambers County, and that is one small county. So what happens is, and then another small county is Harrison County up in this town called, for those of us who don't know, Marshall, Texas, and that's the town where the school Wiley College is, where, you know, they're famous for the Great Debaters movie and that sort of thing. But my point is that those small counties It's the good old boy net. It's the good old boy. What is it? The good old boy network, or whatever they said, old boy network, whatever it is. And you can definitely see the way the stuff is. The judges, I mean, you know it sometimes in your bigger cities too, but definitely in these smaller towns where the sheriff knows everybody. In fact, I was in trial some years ago down in another one of these small towns. Forgive me, I just can't remember what it was, maybe in Jackson County, something like that. But the thing is that the district attorney knew the judge. Obviously, that's not a stretch. But they knew all the jurors. They were all on a first name basis. And in those small towns where everybody knows, and this is how you can kind of tell how the stuff is intertwined a lot of times, and it happens in your big cities, but particularly in your smaller cities where in the same building, you know, in the same court building or you have the judges, you have, and that whole, and under one roof sometimes, and if it's not under one roof, it's definitely right near one another. And so, no one can tell me or convince me that the judicial, practice, if you will, is not intertwined with, the political landscape of those small towns. Somebody would be, in my opinion, extremely naive to think any different. And so, if we look at it then from our perspective, and his brother Kareem would hopefully, well, not hopefully, I'm pretty sure he would expound on it.
Still, we're losing you. We lost you. Brother Kareem, are you there?
Yes, sir. And so what I'll do...
Go ahead. Yeah, so what I would say, so what Brother Thiel described sounds like a good thing to me. If we could close our eyes and say this is Black America, this is a Black small town environment where everybody knows everybody. And I think this is what Brother Kareem is going to explain to us, that sometimes you see in small towns. And if anybody has a question or a comment, please press the number one to get into the host queue. Go ahead, Brother Kareem. Yes, sir.
Thank you. And I want to start by, because I want to give us a view as to how we get to where we at now from Reconstruction as well during the time that we are here today in brief settings. But I want to start right now with talking about something that Henry Holland Garnett once said. I think it was 1878, 79. And he said these words, white folks don't care nothing about Black people going to Washington, D.C. and sitting in the Congress or the Senate. Well, white folks don't want Black people being the sheriff and the judge and the county supervisor in their districts. And so that is the key component when you're talking about politics. When you're talking about politics, this country was built off of interest groups. The interest groups started with the person that had the land, and they wanted, one man said in a book that one white man said he didn't want to own everything. He just wanted to own what was next to him. Now, if you look at that statement, that means he do want to own everything, because once he bought what's next to him, then he want what's next to that. And so white folks always, when they own cattle or when they own certain parts, they wanted to make sure that their interest was taken care of. So one of the major pieces that they would do, they hired him a little gang of a hired gun to make sure that if they wanted the banker to do what they wanted to do, then the banker would do it. If they wanted the newspaper to print what they wanted to print, then they would print it because they had hired guns. And so that was where your interest group started at in your little city. And so they made sure that the sheriff was on their side. that made sure that the judge was on their side. And so they began to make sure that now when you looked up that Mr. Johnson owned the whole town because he bought the judge and everybody. And so this is what we're talking about. We're talking about self-governing. And so from there, those individuals begin to talk about territory. And so now somebody from the territory, Mr. Johnson, because he had the money, he would be the one that they would send to Washington, D.C. to represent them. And so this is what we're looking at when we're talking about the dynamics of politics. Now, put this in the perspective of black people. When we attempted to try to do that in the 1880s, we were making progress at the beginning. But when we began to put demands on white America, we want our school system to be a lot better. We want to be able to have more land. We want to be able to have more in negotiation. White folks say, oh, no, you ain't. And so, therefore, that began to become an odd. And so we were part of the Republican Party. And we thought the Republican Party, those whites that had supported us, would be there when we opposed the Democratic Party, which was the white party that wasn't going to give us none, which used to be the Confederate. But we began to negotiate. White folks that were Republican didn't want us talking about we all down the bag of popcorn neither. So we began to be at odds with both of them. And before we knew it, we had what this time was called a redemption prayer. White folks was now trying to put us back in our place. So by 1877, black people start talking again about separation. That's when you start seeing these black towns all over the country being built because black people wanted to get away from white folks because they had got to the point white folks start lifting up at will. Mm. And black people never accepted that. But we always didn't have enough numbers that we could use to fight. But when we was in enclaves of cities that we did, then you'll find like in East Texas and other places, we didn't have that big a problem. But for the most part, we did. And so we had to go underground in order to achieve what we wanted. And the first thing we did was to get towns, Mount Bayou, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And our objective, as we went in there, Pamela, when we went to Tulsa, I told the viewing audience was that we didn't come there to consider or to reflect back on the 100 years of our onslaught in Black Holocaust, but we came in to call on the spirit of our ancestors of self-determination, Kuja Shakalir, of the spirit of self-governing. And that is what our ancestors attempted to do when you start seeing them build these cities and these towns. But that was not enough. That's what we should have learned from this up until where we are now. For instance, like a city like Greenville. We have a city like Greenville. Go ahead on. I'll let you go ahead on.
Yes, sir. Hold that point. I'm going to take a call, and then you can go into Greenville because, like you say, we couldn't get them to support us then. And because we're right at slavery, we're right at the same savagery back in 1877, 1871, all that time. And so here we are today in 2021, and we want to now go forward into building and making our own communities decent and safe places to live, as well as looking at the political agenda of separation, as you called it. But let's take this call real fast, and then we'll go right back to you, Brother Kareem. And Brother Thiel, are you back on? Is your mic open?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Okay. Yes, sir. I'm going to take this call. Yes. Yes.
Walaikum.
Walaikum salam.
Yeah, brothers and sisters, I am from Cleveland, Mississippi, and I went to school in Mount Bayou. There's a Catholic school that is still there. My whole family was educated there. In Mount Bayou, but
talking
about
yes, ma'am.
Yes, and I want to retire. I want to go back there. I want to go and make that my heaven. But one of the things that I recall, because, you know, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, all that history is tied up together. And I remember Huey P. Long said that fascism was coming to America. And he said this in 1930-something. And pretty soon after that, he was assassinated. You know, so when you talk about politics, this stuff is deep state for real. But when you look at how they brought in these Nazi Germans after the Second World War, and all of that ideology is just soaked into the soil with what they already have. So what we see happening in Australia with the total lockdown where they're going into people's homes, pulling them out because they said something negative about the government, that's here. That's coming here. And so black people, we're used to that kind of treatment. But the impact of it on the Caucasians here, when that hits, I can see what Brother Jabril told us years and years ago, white folks are going to fight. And we're to go in the homes and let them duke it out.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Marguerite. And so what I wanted to say real fast is, again, to just kind of get the topic back, is that we, Brother Kareem, you mentioned the judges. You said they didn't want black people as judges. They didn't want us being our own police chief. You know, we have some history that talks about how black women were a part of organizations that benefited children in the 1800s and the early 1900s. And so this is politics. We're talking about group economics. We're talking about pooling our resources and making our own communities decent and safe places to live. We're talking about black mayors. So you were going to talk to us about, I think, some of that model, you know, and if you could, because I think it's very fascinating.
Yes, and what we're talking about is the history and what we have learned from our history. We are nothing but extensions of our pioneers, Marcus Garvey, as I said, Henry Holland Gardner. All of these individuals were individuals that sought freedom, justice, and equality, but the struggle continues. And so one of the points that I would like, as I go into, I always tell this story about myself growing up as a young boy. I was very intrigued with the cartoon, The Roadrunner. And what I was intrigued about was that coyote was very skillful and he's very creative. And he would always come up with these gadgets to try to catch the Roadrunner. And sometimes he'd be so close, he'd have his his napkins around his neck, a spoon and fork in his hand and dripping at the mouth. But it's something that would always break down. And what was always intriguing about him, instead of him going and rebuild off of that, he going to start all over again. And so I learned from that is that our pioneers, we don't have to rebuild the wheel. All we have to do is just study from them. And so our pioneers tried to have cities and towns that they could begin to do something for themselves, to begin to govern themselves. And so we have that now. The minister told us in 215 to go back in the community and make our places a decent place to live. And he said about a 10,000 fearless team. And of course he wasn't talking about just 10,000 FOIs and MGTs, but a group of black individuals that wanted to do better in their community. And so here in Greenville with the LOC, the LOC is a conglomerate of organizations, entrepreneurs, and individuals working collectively, as we did in 95 to bring 1.7 million men to Washington, D.C. The LOC works in the capacity in the community to be a liaison between the community and the city government, but to make sure that the city government is governing according to freedom, justice, and equality. And so we are here, Greenville, governing ourselves. We got a black mayor. We got a black police chief. We got a black county supervisor. And we take advantage of that as sitting at the table negotiating and planning or strategies how to combat some of the problems and not just tell the governor, I mean the mayor or the county supervisor what they need to do, but we are out front, grassroots organizing, feeding our people ourselves. We are out front, grassroots organizing. We just, the mayor here just finished up and allowing a mass testing. And one of our biggest concerns was that our people don't like those testing, sticking it up in your nose. Now we have in Greenville, we have a mass testing all this week, but they're swab testing. And so this is the influence of black organizers. But what my point is trying to make is that to have your city is not, that's just one state of organizing. Until we get our state and we are able to control the governorship, because this is what happened. When black folks in the 1880s began to organize, white folks began to realize what was going on. In 1890, all of them, starting with Tennessee, then Mississippi, then South Carolina, then Georgia, they began to go in and change the Constitution, the state Constitution, and disenfranchise and voted, wrote black people back out of their state Constitution. Now, it was still against the federal Constitution because you had the 14th Amendment. You had the 13th Amendment. You had the 15th Amendment. It was against that, the federal for them to do that. But state rights is what they exercised. And so this is what we want to talk about, what we should have learned from Wall Street, what we should have learned from Mount Bayou, and how it became one of the most powerful cities in Mississippi, and how they came in there and took it over, how they took over Tuskegee, and to understand that if we're not talking about controlling states, will we now be able to have our own military? Because when we talk about sovereignty, we talk about territorial, like what the message said, we want our own territory or our state. Sovereignty, each state is a country. Mississippi is a country. Indiana is a country. They have their own flag. They have their own sovereignty. They have their own military. Three states that make sovereignty. You got to have land. I think it's at least 300 acres of land. You got to have land. You got to have an army to protect your land. And you got to have resources to feed your people where you can be independent.
Let me interrupt here, because you know we're having a roundtable discussion, and I think the idea is to start brainstorming, to start looking at models, because I think sometimes where you are is a lot further than where a lot of people are. And so when you say that you can impact, you know, certain public policy, that's a large issue. And when you start talking about having greater population of people in a state, that therefore you can impact the electoral process when it gets to that point. But, you know, first I think people have to actually see how political parties, how interest groups, how just gatherings and pooling our resources can even work better in small towns, small subdivisions. And that's a great model. So, we're starting here tonight, and we're not going to be able to go probably all the way to up the organizing process, but we can start by looking at, you know, a place that, what do you have, 78 point something black. And then you have other towns. Don't you have other towns in the vicinity? Sister Marguerite said there's a town called Cleveland. Can you tell us about some of the proximity of other potential black neighbors that, you know, you can pool resources in those types of regions? Because I don't think it's just Mississippi. I think Alabama probably looks a little like this. I think, I'm not sure about Georgia, but I know these rural areas where you have pockets of black towns sprinkled, that I think is an interesting concept for building and pooling resources.
And that's what,
could you
that's
tell us a little bit about that? Could you tell us about it? Because a lot of people don't know how those type of setups look.
Absolutely. And when we, again, that's how we started coming out of the Civil War, the same way was controlling the city. And so in here in Greenville, we have several other cities. You got Metcalf. Its population maybe 400, but it's self-governed. We got Leland. You got Arcola. You got Inabina. So you got seven. This is just in Washington County. You have several little small black cities. But there's a larger percentage of black cities around the Delta that is fully populated with black people. And the self-governed is the key component in that perspective, is that we have the black population, but what we're missing, and remember I talked about sovereignty, the resources is what these types of cities are lacking. The financial wherewithal to be able to take care of their citizens and be well off. Most of these black cities are dependent on white establishments. Like Sister Ava said at the town hall meeting, integration to white people means that we can go and buy their cars, we can go and ride in their airplanes. And so when you look at these cities, Greenville is 80%, 87% black populated, but don't no black man own no new car lot. We own used car lots. And so when you're talking about being independent, even in an all-black population, you have to look at it as well from economic control. And how do we take control of our economics? And again, it begins with education. And who controls the education system? Who controls, where is the money? That's why Garnett said that about, that they don't care nothing about you being in Washington, D.C. What they have a problem with is when you start talking about you want to split up them tax dollars and put some more money in your school system, or you want to, Congressman Benny Thompson a couple weeks ago said these words to us. He said it about Bolivar County, Washington County, LaFleur County. He said all these counties have over 200 school boards. And if those school boards would begin to buy the luncheon that they get for one or two black vendors, that would change the dynamic of economics in this area. And so those are just more dynamics than when we talk about interest groups. How do they within a city, do those interest groups are heard that the city mayor or the county begin to negotiate for us where we get those revenues when that money comes down? We get those contracts. And that's what we want to talk about. That's what the alignment was built
on. Yes, sir. And that, I think it's a good point, very, very good point. When you talk about making our communities decent and safe places to live, talk to us, because many of us live in the bigger urban areas, and Brother Kareem, you came from bigger urban areas, so you know how it is. These streets are very, we got a lot of crime, just put it mildly. And so, you know, when you look at some of the small town living, does it seem that it could be manageable, that there is, you know, some safety or some peace and serenity in these areas for families?
Well, again, it goes back to what the Honorable Ms. Farrakhan told us in 2015, what he gave us as a pledge in 1995, and that is that the black man are responsibility. It's not the Chinese man. It's not the Caucasian man, it's the black man's responsibility to clean his own community up. And so what we are facing with when we're talking about black men coming together, that's where those interest groups, that's where that national agenda is so important. That's why when we come at the table of the LOC, we find a common denominator that we can agree upon moving forward. And so you got to come in with the LOC. You can't come in the LOC and bring to the table a Christmas tree. You can't bring Halloween. We promote culture. We promote family principles. And so with that, then when you got 8, 9 black men and 4 or 5 black women, and some of them are Christians, some of them are Muslims, some of them go to church, some of them don't, But we all can agree upon one thing. How can we make grandma's house better that is falling down? How can we address mental illness? What are the perspectives or what are some of the issues that we can address? And who do we look for first? First, we look in the community. Then we look for the resources from the city and county government to help us. But whether they help us or not, our people have always, they called it double taxing. In our community,
yes,
black
sir.
People always paid for their own school system. They always paid for their own roads. And so whether
we do it
or not, we have to come together and say that we're going to be the one that's going to feed our people. We'll educate our children. We'll finance the education system. And so we have to have models. And so here in Greenville, that's what we're looking at.
Yes, sir. Because let me specifically ask you.
Go
ahead, Brother Thiel.
If I may, you know, in answering that question also or following up on it, I think it certainly is possible. Just look at, you know, what we did in Washington, D.C. in 1988, you know, when we went into Mayfair Mansions, you know, and Brother Nabat was on, you know, on the show about a month ago talking about it. So, you know, when we went into Mayfair and then the adjoining community, Paradise housing development, literally right behind it. Well, you know, if you visited that community, literally in the midst of everything that was going on in D.C., community, Mayfair Mansions and Paradise Manor, that was the name of the complex, you had a Muslim community. Not only brothers and sisters, Muslim brothers and sisters living there, you know, our own community for the most part, but we were the ones who, you know, we policed it. We made sure that people didn't go hungry. All of this, you know, there was no police activity there. So that was a tremendous model. And so it can be done. It starts small sometimes and would have to grow. But it can be done because that was the perfect example of, you know, what it is, you know, making our communities a safe place to live and making sure we provided the protection and we also provided the spiritual upliftment. We provided the moral upliftment and everything else. The children were safe and everything could come out to play and all of that stuff. And it was us. And, you know, the police wouldn't come there, had no need to. We were the police force. Yes,
and
right.
If I may address that briefly, and you're absolutely right when you talk about models, but what I want us to leave away from here today with when we're talking about a political agenda of separation and we're talking about finances and economics, even in those clients that we had with those little communities, we still was not financially stable. Let me give an example of something.
And before you go into that, because Brother Kareem, we're down to about 10 minutes, I think the point before we move away from it is that in a place like a small southern city such as a Greenville or a Cleveland, the mentality of the police department is not to commit police brutality against its own black people. There's a mentality of we are brothers and sisters, and you may have some bad apples anywhere you go, but you don't have the type of contempt and hatred of, you know, where you find in these bigger cities a white police force who is just like patrolling the black community because I want to bust them heads. And the type of mistreatment that comes. And I just think that's a plus. So I wanted to make that known, too, because a lot of people don't know about these havens, Brother Kareem, but go ahead. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Yeah.
You please.
And you're absolutely right. But we want to also make sure that we give the total perspective of it in the problems that we're addressing, even in these black communities, because white America has had, as the minister said, they have made up into themselves. Even in these black enclaves that we have, they're still pushing the shot. They're still pushing white folks' ideology. They still push Christmas, Santa Claus, and they do very little participation in Kwanzaa and Juneteenth. And so even with that white supremacy, the opposite of that is black inferiority. So you might have all black police officers, but the mindset of them toward their black people is that the black people are the problem. That if there be some shooting, they first thing they want to do is go get ATF and bring them in. And so we have to continue to show them another perspective. That is why it's important to have organizations in the community collectively working. The New Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam, 100 Black Men, the National Association for Black Women, and the AME churches and others working collectively together through the black perspective.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I think still in small towns, you still have a certain amount of a value system that exists in some of the population, the neighbors, that although everyone is being pulled into this filth and degeneracy that we find in the bigger cities, but you just don't find it at the same level. And it a lot of times, because we didn't get a chance to go into the migration that happened in these cities that pulled some of the brains and, you know, some of the, you know, some of the economically, you know, maybe rich people or whatever out of the towns and left their brethren who are just as sound, just as capable, just as able, but they're by themselves. So perhaps, you know, the people need help in small towns, and we need to look at that. And so, you know, but I think the good thing, Brother Kareem and Brother Athil, any time in the past we've had political conversations outside of you know, outside of the nation, you know, since I joined the mosque, since you joined the mosque, you know, when we were probably younger, you know, there would always be a bunch of, you know, everybody has the debate. Everybody has their part. Everybody has their point. And that's okay. You know, I think it's okay. So to have had a conversation like that tonight where we are talking about seeking freedom, justice, and equality. And as Sister Marguerite said, we want the full and complete freedom, justice, and equality. You know, this is just how it looks. We're brothers and sisters, and, you know, this type of conversation is so needed. Because me personally, I'm tired of looking at the government to do for us what we are going to have to do ourselves. So, you know, any closing remarks? We're down to 7 minutes, and I thank you all once again. Brother Kareem, Brother Athil, would you like to make any closing remarks?
If Athil can speak, if not, then I for sure that with me, I just definitely would like for
one of the things that I would end with is, you know, remembering what the minister, you know, told and one of the lecture tours. Politics without economics is symbol without substance. And so, you know, as Brother Kareem was alluding to, you know, we have to have the resources to do these things, you know, self-policing, self, you know, in our communities, whatever the situation might be, you know, creating our own political agenda, our own political reality, our own, you know, in these pockets, if you will, in these small communities that grow. Resources are something that is certainly needed. But it's not only, you know, certainly economics is there, part of it, but it's also we have to pull our intelligent, you know, our intellectual resources. We have to pull all these different things. That's the way we're going to get our community stronger. And as you were saying, Sister Pamela, you know, when also we're dealing with, you know, accepting responsibility. Well, accepting responsibility for our communities to, you know, to make our communities decent and better places to live. You know, if we don't, you know, put on that armor and use that as something that it's my responsibility, it's Brother So-and-so's responsibility. You know, we can't, as you were saying, continue to look for the government, you know, to do, you know, the basic things that we, you know, should do for ourselves. For instance, you know, we know, we always hear this so often, you know, we go to the black community, we see that that they don't pick up the trash, and, you know, these little small things that we would say, well, it's the city government's responsibility. But what's wrong with you picking up your own trash? You know, I mean, now that may be small, minute in the grand scheme of things, but my thought has always been, if you can't do something that simple, then you are going to be hard-pressed to do something on a more grander scale. And I'm not trying to trivialize it, but I think it goes down to kind of like, again, which, as you were saying, Sister Pamela, accepting responsibility, which is not a difficult thing for us to
yes,
do.
Sir.
And if we do that,
yes,
we
sir.
Can continue, in my opinion, being successful.
Praise be to Allah. Yes, sir. Brother Kareem, you got it. Would you like to close? We got a couple of minutes on that. And do you
absolutely.
Have any closing remarks? Yes, sir.
Thank you, sister, for allowing us to come on. I would just like to close with what the messenger told us, is that as black people, we're going to have to be retrained and re-educated all over again. Dominic Barton, 215, that we need to get in the Justice or Else Party. We need to come out of the Republican Party and Democrat Party. So I think that moving forward, I would like for us to begin to evaluate and look at what does a Justice or Else Party look like. What are we talking about when we're talking about interest groups, that what makes up a political party? What are those interest groups when we're talking about health issues that address the black community, domestic violence that addresses the black community, prison reform that addresses the black? These are different interest groups within inside the black community that we need to begin to bring to the table up under the national agenda and begin to see how we can develop a framework that we can pull, as Brother Thayer said, our intellectuals together so that we can have, as we did with the reparation movement and others, begin to go on a circuit that we can formulate from the national agenda, as we did after 05. It took us 3 years with that agenda to put a black man in the office because of our organizational skills. Now we have to go to that same level once again with the Just L Party, but I'm looking at talking about that from the perspective of going in and beginning to talk about taking these states over, Mississippi, Alabama, those states that have 2, 3 million, 4 million people in it. As the messenger said, as I close, when he said about teaching Islam to black people, he had one path they on. With black American Mississippi, we 1.4 million, so that means that we got one path made on. Now all we have to do is learn how to organize. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Praise be to Allah. Well, thank you so much. And I would like to say thank you all once again for being a guest on our show tonight, A Time for Justice. And thank you all for listening to A Time for Justice. To hear previous shows, you can log on to Blog Talk Radio. And we invite you to visit the archives. We also would like to thank the Elevated Places team. We would like to thank Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad. Encourage all of the listeners to listen to her show, Ask Dr. Ava, which comes on Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. I would also like to thank Sister Donna Muhammad, Brother Terrence Muhammad, and Sister Samaya Muhammad, who is my helper on our show, A Time for Justice. Thank you all once again for listening, and tune in next week for more informative discussions. As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam, family.